I'd like to welcome you to the meeting of our Afghanistan Working Group. My name is Beth Coldegrass. I'm a Senior Program Officer with our Center for Post-Conflict Peace and Stability Operations. Today we're going to look at the current situation in Afghanistan. Judging by the number of people here, I can see it's a topic of concern. There are many, many reports in the newspapers every day. We're all getting called by reporters to ask us exactly what is going on in Afghanistan. There are rising casualties. There are insurgent tactics that look like Iraq. There are increased coalition and Afghan force operations in the south and southeast. There is a fear among the population, indeed a fear of being seen with government officials. There are suicide bombings. There are Afghans being targeted that are going to work in U.S. and coalition facilities. So the question that we have today is this a renewed war? Are we really at war in the south? Is the government and the international community losing control of Afghanistan? And recently the question is being asked, is President Karzai really in trouble? We are very privileged today to have two people that can help us to answer these questions. I myself believe that the glass is more half full, and there is a lot to be encouraged about in Afghanistan, but we have experts that are far more knowledgeable than me that can answer these questions for us. Minister Jalali, who last joined us in August in a closed session when he was Minister of the Interior, is now in Washington at the National Defense University, and we're indeed honored to have him. You have his bio, so I'm not going to go over his many accomplishments, but he has been both as an Afghan fighting for his country, but also reporting on his country and the wider region for a very, very long time. He helped build Afghanistan's police force from the ground up and was responsible for dealing with militias and warlords and disarmament of militias and all of those critical challenges that happened in the beginning of many of these missions. We also have Amin Tarzi, who is Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and I was delighted to see that he's not just a beat reporter. He has a PhD from New York University in Middle Eastern Studies. So he also has a deep expertise and knowledge about the subject today. I'm going to turn to Minister Jalali. I can't stop calling you Minister. and he'll offer his remarks, and then Amin will follow, and then we'll open it up for discussion.
Thank you very much, Beth. It's always a pleasure to be here with the Institute, and I'm also pleased to see so many old friends and familiar faces. And my friends all over. And also, I'm happy that Lou could make it. We worked together in Afghanistan. He was the head of Afghanistan Reconstruction Group at the embassy. We interacted a lot there and shared the same views on the reconstruction and rehabilitation of Afghanistan. First thing first, my remarks reflect my own personal views, not necessarily those of the National Defense University or the Department of Defense. The questions that you send me, Beth, are very intriguing questions, very difficult to answer them, but you said it very well that the glass is half full, but at the same time I would say that now with the recent upsurge in violence, people are looking at the glass half empty. So the half empty part is becoming very prominent here. News headlines these days about Afghanistan are very gloomy. They paint a very gloomy picture and a negative picture of Afghanistan. Well, as a former journalist, I understand that the news is the bad news, or bad news is the news. So, however, all these news do not tell the whole story. Still, with the deterioration of security situation, the lack of progress in governance and economic reconstruction in Afghanistan. No one, including me, can paint a rosy picture on Afghanistan as it was the case 2 years ago, and when Afghanistan was held up as a success story. Why such a contrast now? one has to look for answers in the dynamism of the post-conflict transition in Afghanistan. The panic over continued upsurge of violence in Afghanistan during the recent weeks reflecting disenchantment on two levels. Disenchantment of the Afghan people with a weak and indecisive government that has failed to seize the opportunity and bring positive changes in people's lives. Second, disenchantment of the Afghan government with the international community for failing to provide sufficient resources for building state institutions, including security forces and reconstruction of the Afghan economy. There are two consequences to this. Mutual pointing a finger of blame and renewed reliance of Afghan leadership on non-state power holders, militias, and warlords. What's the way out? Before I go to the question, the way out is a reassessment of policies for both sides. The Afghanistan Compact in February actually was a partnership. And in that partnership, it was expected that Afghanistan will do its part and the international community will do its part. If Afghanistan wants the international community to reassess its policies, its approach to the problems, at the same time, the international community also expects Afghanistan government to reassess its policies, look back its policies. And however, unfortunately these days, this disenchantment that exists is a danger that Afghanistan being or convinced that the international community is not delivering the way it should deliver, goes back to the old warlords, militias, in bringing those people who were sidelined during the past 3 years under the reform process. Before I go to the questions that Beth actually posed, who these insurgents are, who they are, where do they get the support, what does it mean for Afghanistan, the future of Afghanistan, there are a number of key points. These are both academic at the same time. I've seen it firsthand in my life, in practical life in Afghanistan. The first, the line between conflict and post-conflict phases is indistinct. A post-conflict situation can develop into conflict situation if not managed well. Well, 3 years ago in 2002, Afghanistan was a post-conflict society. Today, it is both. Part of Afghanistan is post-conflict, part of it is conflict. In the south and southeast, it is a conflict condition. So the second, the post-conflict transition to peace and stability in Afghanistan is not a static but a highly dynamic process. Failure to respond to interlinked challenges in a coordinated way spawns new challenges, renewed threats, and opportunity spoilers. After the downfall of the Taliban, Afghanistan faced enormous challenges, many tasks, a multiple of tasks. And they were all interlinked. Progress in one area affects the progress in another area, the lack of progress in another area. And they are all, so therefore, an integrated and comprehensive approach should be taken in order to respond to them. Failure to integrate all these responses, spawns new problems. At the same time, you have many actors, domestic actors and international actors. And they come with different level of commitment, different level of resources, different procedures, different agendas. Lack of coordination between them undermines the integrated approach that is required to address all these problems. So therefore, this dynamism actually also affects the domestic actors. In the post-conflict conditions, the process of rebuilding is not just rebuilding or building. It is rebuilding, building, and deconstructing. It's a process of breaking and making. You have to break something in order to make something. While the people expected that the dismantlement of militia will mean that they will no longer be able to influence the lives of the people, that did not happen. Well, the militia were dismantled. However, an alternative was not created for these people to be absorbed, so they joined other illegal armed groups, drug networks, and also local networks of warlords. So although the National Army was built, was created, National Police was created, however, the existence of non-state actors undermined the capacity of these new institutions. So it is a process of making and breaking. Unless you create alternatives to the lives of former combatants, they will continue to undermine the peace process. Then there's no military solution to Taliban-led insurgency in Afghanistan. Military actions are to be supplemented by building security capacity, good governance, and development. The nature of this war, actually, from the beginning, the international community and coalition forces did not come to Afghanistan initially, or basically, to rebuild the country. They came to overthrow the Taliban. And then later on, in order to prevent the coming back of the Taliban, started rebuilding the country. However, the initial motive, the initial reason, continues to cast a long shadow on the whole process of rebuilding. And so therefore, the focus was on military success, military achievement. Now, the Taliban were not defeated, they were removed. So therefore, there was a possibility to come back. Now, too much focus on fighting the Taliban or the terrorists actually, undermined the attention to other aspects of reconstruction. And on the other hand, the post-conflict expectation of people. Sometimes we hear that, expectations were not met or there were high expectations. But Afghans had very, very modest expectation after the fall of the Taliban. What they wanted was security, that's all, after so many years of war. They didn't care that they should vote for in an election in 1 year or vote for parliament in 2 years. They didn't care if there was a new restaurants, new radio station. What they wanted was human security. To be free of fear from everybody, from the government, from the police, from the warlords, from the militia, from coalition forces, from ISAF, free from fear. And also have access to justice. Although you had elections, presidential elections, you have a very enlightened constitution, parliamentary elections, but the people, those who terrorized people in the past were still there. The militias, the commanders and villages, and even some of them came back and filled the ranks of police, ranks of the army. So that's security. Security of want, or freedom from want. That is opportunities, not promises, not policies, no matter what kind of a policy you have, how many pledges the international community makes, how many money the internationally pour into the country. But if the opportunity is not created, this expectation is not going to be met. So therefore, the expectations were modest, but they were not met. It is not the expectation, a high expectation, as sometimes people said, after the fall of the Taliban, people had high expectation, and these high expectations were not fulfilled. It's very modest expectation. So now I come to the main question. Who are the insurgents? What do they want? Who is supporting them from outside and also from inside? When I went to Afghanistan in 2003, I didn't see much of the Taliban or the insurgents. After the fall of the Taliban, many of them went back to Pakistan. Some of them went to their villages. And although they were potential, potential threats, but at that time, they were inactive. And in 2003, when I faced three, hostage, situations. In one case, a group kidnapped one Turkish worker when I was responsible for protecting the construction of Kabul-Kandahar Highway, that major highway. A Turkish engineer was kidnapped in Zabul province. And later on, two Indians were kidnapped, and the same route. And then another, Turkish engineer was kidnapped. In all these cases, I was able to use the tribal mechanism in the area to win their freedom. Because the people were supporting the government at that time, in Zabul. The tribals, the people. In all cases, it's very interesting, the person who actually was instrumental, this was a person who is now a member of parliament, and a former commander of the first corps of the Taliban, Salam Rakhti. You have heard his name. Salam Rakhti was involved in going to these tribals and actually asking them that this is a disgrace to these people. And they actually prevented the small group that was active there to take the hostages to Pakistan, and they were freed without, you know, any demand. They did not even make a demand at that time. So there was a lot of support there. And although in Helmand, Oruzgan, Zabul, at that time, you had a small contingent of coalition forces in Kandahar. You had one or two fire bases in there, nothing else. And that area was calm. At that time, many people from the Taliban side were contacting the government to come back, provided their security be guaranteed. However, there were many actors there. Coalition forces, ISAF, Afghan government, and then Afghan government, the Ministry of Defense, Ministry of Interior, and also the NDS. And they wanted a guarantee from all of these. That such a mechanism was not existing there. So the now the so the way the war ended actually left Taliban forces intact, however, at the side of the boundary, most of them were inside the country. And then attempts to attract the attention or to make themselves relevant for Pakistani parties and Al-Qaeda. In those days, 2003, I'm talking 2003, 2004, most of the people we arrested as they would come for sabotage or bombing or attacking police security posts, there were many of them either hired or paid, or people were actually doing it just for one time, and that was all. Very uncoordinated and just opportunistic. At that time, they wanted to show to their supporters, which were mean Al-Qaeda and also Pakistani religious parties, that they are still relevant. At the same time, Pakistan was not looking at Taliban the same way they looked at Al-Qaeda. They made a distinction between Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Many of the Talibanis who came back said that they were told that they have a political future in Afghanistan, while Al-Qaeda does not have a political future anywhere. So therefore, they had this hope and also support of some of these parties. So they started creating network. Then the attempts were made in 2004 to reach, while they saw Helmand, Oruzgan in Zabul province, devoid of significant security capacity. They started negotiating with officials to don't touch us, we will not touch you. We will not fight you, we will not attack you, don't attack us. This way they made inroads in these areas, create a network. And then they were looking for an opening. This is very, very, similar to the strategy that is now being promoted by Al-Qaeda-related strategists. Most of them are secular. They are doing it on the internet. And some people like Abu Hajar Abdullah Al-Muqran or Abu Masab al-Suri, these people, that create a network, win people. When we see an opening, then strike. And later on, start with the small guerrilla attacks, IEDs, suicide bombing, then create bases. And they have started bases late last year. and ungoverned areas. Ungoverned areas are always weak, the weak point of the government. Ungoverned area, not necessarily in post-conflict situation, conflict. Ungoverned areas are everywhere. Even in the United States, you go to some parts of Los Angeles or New York, probably you have some ungoverned areas. Or in any other countries, civilized countries. So ungoverned areas are everywhere. So therefore, they wanted to find ungoverned areas. There is a district in Dikundi. It's called Gizab. Gizab is between originally it was, we do not have a map of Afghanistan, unfortunately, but those who are familiar, Gizab is the southern or northern district of Uruzgan province. Uruzgan is north of Kandahar. And this Gizab is between now Uruzgan and Dikundi province. Half of them are Pashtun, half Hazara. Now they have a dispute that the Pashtuns want to remain in Uruzgan province, which is a Pashtun province. The Hazaras want to become part of Dikundi, which officially it belongs to Dikundi. So there are many, many areas you do not have the presence of the government, you do not have police there. So this area is being used as a base. Then go to Zabul province. In Zabul, there were a dispute between Tukhis and Tarakis, Hutakis, two major Ghilzai tribes of the area. A governor, a Tukhi governor, actually out of tribal rivalry, oppressed the Hutaks in 2004-2003. And Hutak happens to be the tribe of Mullah Omar. And many of these Hutaks left this area, went to Badini and in the Al-Ajargai area across the border in Pakistan. And no matter how much attempt was made, but they were very, very unhappy. Although some Hutaks returned. So they want to use this. So some bases were established in the Hutak areas in the southern part of Uruzgan province, like Khaki Afghan and Nowbahar. And in the north, in Dai Chopan area, that's also a mountainous area. And so, having said this, what is a district in Afghanistan? During the war, these districts, the buildings were destroyed. When we say a center of district are two huts here and there and a few police sitting there, a bunch of gunmen can come and fight fight a few shots, destroy the hut with an RPG-7, and then they film it and take it their supporters and say, okay, that district was destroyed and the Taliban actually occupied the district of Dai Chopan or Chora. This is not true. Two huts there. So at the same time, the Iraq war actually created a new situation, a new condition. After the Iraq war, we see a closer ties, closer coordination between Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and Hikmatyar and Jalaluddin Al-Qaeda. Today, you have a more organized in new group forces along northeast, east, and southern parts of Afghanistan. In the northeast, you have Hikmatyar and helped mostly by Lashkar-e-Taiba in Nuristan. In the central, in Waziristan area, you have Jalaluddin Haqqani and his groups. And in the south, you have Taliban, Balochistan, totally Taliban. The approach of Pakistan actually deployed about 80,000 troops in the area, but most of them were involved in Waziristan area against Al-Qaeda. Not much action was taken or conducted in the Balochistan area, in Quetta area. So therefore, whether it is intentional, or it is because the lack of access to these areas, it's still an open question. So, with the deployment of NATO, a new opening, a new situation was created. You remember that the Dutch Parliament was debating the issue whether to go or not to go to Uruzgan. At that time, the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda used it as a week that it is possible to it would be easier to go after NATO in the south. And also, even they in their propaganda said that the replacement of the U.S. forces by NATO in the south means that the United States was defeated, it is withdrawing from the south. So this created a situation that people actually became very disappointed and lost hope. So now today, if you go to 3 years ago, when the Kabul-Kandahar highway was built, people were telling some of the Taliban, look, the international community is here to build it, we build the country. In the beginning, they said they will not do it, and they will attack it, we will not let them do this. Later on, they would not say, and the people were laughing at them. Today, when you go to Lashkar Gah, they tell the same thing to people. So if the international community was here to help Afghanistan people, why don't you see a change in your lives? And they have nothing to say. And today, you have many people, as is the actual trend in an unstable condition, they are on the fence, whether to go this way or that way, to have them, or in other words, to hedge their bets, to keep their options open. So although Afghanistan willingly is not going to back to the Taliban era, no, not never. If the country is hit by chaos, that will be because the people do not see change in their lives. They are disenchanted with the system. They're disenchanted with the international community. Disenchanted with the government do for them. So therefore, it is not the Taliban. Taliban are exploiting this situation. And the sooner the government and the international community make, you know, a change or do some tangible things that will give the perception that the people, see a change in their lives, the Taliban are not able to exploit this. Because people have tested them, their ideology, their political vision, their leadership were long ago rejected by the Afghan people. Now, if you do not have an alternative to the Taliban for security, people will either cooperate with them or stay aloof, will not do anything with the government. There was one person who, contacted the government long ago that was linked with the Taliban. He said he realized that Taliban do not have a future, but he will not, fight the government. However, if the government continues to do this, he will go and stay in the area, will help neither side, Taliban nor the government. So this is the inactivity, the disenchantment that is going to undermine the peace process, not the Taliban themselves. I think how much time I have? 3 minutes, okay. What is the way out? There's a question, are the Taliban, narco mafia, local warlords, I think I said they are all in cooperating in the south. So, 3 years ago, we started a program called Afghanistan Stabilization Program, ASP. That program was similar to the ink spot theory of reconstruction that NATO is usually promotes. Ink spot, theory is to start reconstruction stabilization from an area and expand it, if you cannot do it everywhere. The idea of ASP, Afghan Stabilization Program, was to rebuild the center of districts. The district's centers were destroyed during the war. The physical infrastructure was not there. So the idea was to rebuild the physical infrastructure. And then after the building of the physical infrastructure, appoint or deploy well-trained, well-armed, well-paid police force in the area. Not from that area, but national police in the area. And then also appoint well-educated, well-trained, and competitive and brave district administrators. So when you establish a physical infrastructure, including the barracks for police, offices for the district government, a prison, a clinic, a mosque, a library, a post office, a bank, and telecommunication center. That was the deal. To build it, this serves as a magnet for people. They come, they invest, they will. And all these district centers will develop into a kind of a townships and small towns. That, in Afghanistan, there are 365 districts. And my preference was to start it in the unstable areas in the south. Well, that program was started, however, it was slow. And later on, the interdepartmental, you know, turf battle actually slowed the process. And recently I heard that the United States, I think the USAID and Canada has withdrawn their money from this project because they are not satisfied with the pace of progress. However, this project is now very slow, and this project is nearly defunct. I think the revival of this kind of a project is going to be the best approach, the key to two things: the fighting insurgency, and the sense of winning the trust and confidence of the people, and also finally providing the human security in those areas. I think the total cost of this project was $350 million. And you should realize that the cost of military operation in Afghanistan a year is $12 to $18 billion. So therefore, these things are to be reassessed. And I think the Afghanistan Compact, which was accepted both by the international community in Afghanistan government in February, is a very good blueprint. However, 6 months after the compact was agreed upon, you do not see any progress, any action. Business as usual is the name of the game today. I think this is the time that the board that the compact suggested to be established there, the board co-chaired by the UNEMA chief or the special representative of the United Nations in Kabul, and also a senior official from the Afghan government, and then composed of the representative of the Afghan government and the international community. I think now this is the time to expand this, to reassess the policies, and also try to implement all the actions included in the Afghanistan Compact. And the key to stability, as a final word, the key to stability in Afghanistan is human security. Human security to give the people the hope for the future. Otherwise, it will be survival. With survival, corruption, instability, and all these are attacked with survival. They will survive. So therefore, human security is the key to stability. I think I will stop here. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Amin.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much. Going after Minister Jalali is not easy. He was in the field, and I was watching him at the time and writing about his activities. But I will try to look at the same situation and try to answer those questions from my own perspective as someone who's looked at Afghanistan for about 25 years as a Cold Warrior, and then as an academic, and then now I analyze it, with quotation marks. And before anything else, I will try to say the same thing that Minister Jalali said. Since I do work for an organization that's paid by the U.S. government, these are my own views and not necessarily reflect the views of U.S. Congress or any RFERL. I'll begin by saying that if you have read your newspapers, watched your regular newscast, even in the United States.
But most of them were involved in with
between various interlocutors in Afghanistan is over. That honeymoon, I don't cannot tell you when, but definitely in the last few weeks it has ended. If you read some of the major papers in this town, we are that honeymoon has gone to even close to a divorce. I think that if you look at it to that negative, it's an exaggeration, and you know, you even hear of issues that President Karzai is thinking of stepping down. And my view is that those exaggerations are there because, as Minister Jalali said, there's a lot of finger pointing because of a underlying frustration on different levels by different people. This includes the United States. This includes NATO. And I want to say that I just came from another conference. The United States is a member of NATO. We hear all this, that NATO versus the United States, as if the United States is not a NATO member. When I say United States here, I mean United States-led coalition forces, or the OEF. But U.S. is, and as far as I know, still remains a member of NATO. So NATO-led coalition, OEF, Operation Enduring Freedom, NATO itself, which is leading the International Security Assistance Force, ISAF, Afghanistan, within Afghanistan, and I have to bring in Pakistan. All these four factors, and there are outside factors beyond them, but I will concentrate on these. There are frustrations and there are policy shifts in all four categories. There seems to be some level of confusion or realignment going on, or thought about that realignment. I think that is a premise. If whether the glass is empty or full, that's a question that in Afghanistan you have heard it. I think if we look at all the achievements, you know, the major 4 million people returning back to their country, 6 million students in the in schools of Afghanistan, economic growth over 10%, voting in presidential parliamentary elections, parliament functioning to a degree, a new constitution. I do have my questions about the constitution, whether or not it's the best model, but I will leave that aside. And I think the most vivid and positive change in the life of Afghan women. These are very major positive things. But if you look at it from the other perspective, there's a but on each and every one of them. And I think I do agree with Minister Jalali that those buts, they were not very, very major demands by the Afghan people or major hopes. Some of them were very small. But we have to go back in Bonn. When Bonn was happening, Bonn was more like a check mark. Constitution this date, election this date. It was a check mark done in a time of crisis, trying to find a void for when the Taliban are ousted. And there was a good agreement. Right now, when you look at it, maybe with unrealistic benchmarks and date marks, and those were always wonderful achievements. Thus, Afghanistan became, at least in the United States, not in Europe so much, a model of how to create a democratic system in a Muslim country. Failed state part was kind of left alone, but it was a failed state. We have to think about that also. I don't think that model is anymore being flashed around anywhere. The Europeans never really bought it that much, but even here, you don't see that model because a lot of those check marks were done, and now it is functionality. Okay, we have a constitution. We have a president who was elected. So what is happening now? Now the blame game happens because at the end it was always, okay, we are finishing the bond process. And I think we have to look at it in this context of what is happening. Of course, there's another issue that we look at that is that the security situation has gotten bad. We can look at it various ways. One way to look at it is the security situation has gotten bad because the OEF and NATO is actually now fighting, are trying to push out, using the Defense Department term, the bad guys, to clear up the situation for the July takeover of NATO and the phase three, the southern part. So once you push in, there will be more fighting, which is a realistic issue. I happen to be a former Marine. I know when you go to combat, there's always reaction. So action begets reaction. But also, if we think that there is no new phenomenon on the ground, we'll be missing the boat. I think for Afghanistan, it will be a disservice for all the interlocutors to miss the fact that there is a change with the enemy. And I will come to the point in the question, who is the enemy? And also another thing I want to posit, which is not a very positive issue, is we have always looked with the two wars that the United States is fighting right now, Iraq and Afghanistan. Iraq was always the bad news, Afghanistan was the good news. But within Afghanistan you had the bad news areas, the southern areas. Always it was south, southeast, pockets of badness, but the north was good. Unfortunately that is changing also. People are totally forgetting about the north. The north is getting, there are pockets in the north that are becoming more and more hostile, there are more school burnings in the north, more attacks in the north, more disenchantment within different communities in the north. Saripol, Balkh, Badghis in particular, right in, smack in the north of Afghanistan. So this thing is spawning to the north. I don't want to be a bad news bearer, but I hope we don't come back to that and think what happened in the north. It is coming beyond this, the south. That's another issue that we have to look at. Why is this happening? Why it's not diminishing, but rather it actually is being pushed forward. Just a number for you. Since April this year, there has been 27 suicide bombings in Afghanistan. 27. That is, for a country that had zero when the war began, it's a huge number. Meanwhile, at the same time, the number of troops right now in Afghanistan, both the OEF and NATO, are larger than any point during the operation and during freedom. Right now, I give you the specific, the U.S. Official numbers. We have more than 26,000 coalition forces in Afghanistan, of which 18,500 are U.S., 7,500 are allied nations, which includes 25 countries. And then we have NATO, which is increasing in numbers. So you have the largest number of troops, but also the increase in activities of the enemies, which is something, again, we have to look at it. Within this frustration, I think what illustrates it very, very vividly is some of the statements coming in from Kabul. When President Karzai sits down and says, we cannot allow you to kill Taliban because, and I quote, they are the sons of this land. Is he showing his frustrations openly, or is this a tact to bring the U.S.-led coalition and NATO to the point that this is not the way to fight it, but what to do? Go for the source. The source, it's very obvious. President Karzai sometimes names the source. The source is Pakistan. Sometimes they do not name the source. Go for the source where the trainings are done, where the schools are burned. Basically, the blame game from Kabul is the Taliban are not important. It is who finances the Taliban, who makes the Taliban more radical, or radicalizes them, or who gives the Taliban their weapons and so on and so forth. And his view is that it is all Pakistan, or mainly Pakistan. That's calling on the coalition, NATO, US, to go and deal with the Taliban. I'm sorry, with Pakistan, not with the Taliban. He also has a problem within his own constituents with the issue of who is supporting him. He tries to deal with the democratic issue, and he does that very well. And when he has a gathering, people say, no, we do not agree with you. And some reasons are that, you have no security. At least under the Taliban, we have security. As Minister Jalali rightfully ended his word, in my view also, until you bring human security, we look at the Taliban as this absolutely medieval, totally dysfunctional system. They were to a degree. The parts of Afghanistan that they governed and there was security. Today, some people may even look at that as good old days, as hard as it is believed. Good old days was that my daughter or son was not abducted or raped, or I could go and walk out of my room. Yeah, maybe my wife couldn't, but you know what? That was the culture anyway. Afghanistan was never Norway, and it cannot become Norway overnight. So this notion is that I think the Bonn Agreement and the ideology by the West was expecting too much. Afghans were not expecting too much, and right now those expectations are clashing. Leaving the room, which is the unfortunate part, is leaving the room for the Taliban. And here I want to say, who are the enemy? I think the fact that nobody expected this to happen is also the fact that nobody wants to identify this enemy. I personally have coined the word, borrowed it from a friend 4 years ago now, I coined it, I call it the Neo-Taliban. not to create another acronym in this wonderful town. We have so many acronyms, but to try to say that these people who are fighting the government administration of President Karzai are not the same Taliban that were ousted, and I agree with Minister Jalani, not defeated, but ousted in December, finally December 5th, Mullah Omar sat on a motorcycle and rode across the border to Pakistan. December 5th, I guess the date is, in 2001. These are not the same people. This is the enemy today in Afghanistan is a group of people who use the name of the Taliban. Some of them are either sympathizers or people who work with the Taliban. The leadership could or could not be there. If Mullah Omar is dead today, does not matter at all to what is going on in Afghanistan today. He may be dead right now. It doesn't matter. At the same time, there are people who are certain aspects of the Afghan war were let go. There was a sequencing going on. NATO still believes in sequencing. Okay, you go and build a road, and then once we build a road, we build a hospital, and then 5 years from now, we deal with narcotics. Well, unfortunately, we do not have that luxury. The narcotic situation, the corruption situation, they're all feeding into this enemy that I call the Neo-Taliban because they are using the name Taliban. The Afghan government now, at least parts of the Afghan government, even within the Afghan government, there are different versions. If you want to know who's on which side, and one of the ways to find out, read their statements, who calls the Taliban Taliban, who calls them terrorists, who calls them enemies of peace and security. That will tell you which side or what mindset they're looking at. So these enemies of peace and security, when we sit in a situation we cannot even identify the enemy or unwilling to identify the enemy, shows a confusion about the objective. Again, as a military person, when you go for an objective, first and foremost what you do is you identify your enemy, its strength, and then the terrain, how to go about it, and the objective of that war. I think those are lost right now because nobody wants to know the enemy. Because within the enemy, there's also an aspect of these are the good people. You hear from anywhere from the fact that only 100 of them are bad. We have never seen the list. Or at one point, some people even said we pardon all of them, including Osama bin Laden and Mullah Omar. Of course, that was taken back. Even within that notion of reconciliation with the Taliban, which has not really worked very well, there's confusion. So within this, all of that comes in another outside issue. The outside issue is, and again with the enemy, I want to mention that enemy, if you want to deal with the enemy in Afghanistan, it is not only the issue of the Taliban and their sympathizers, it is not only a Pashtun issue. It is not only a Pashtun issue. It's not just disenchanted Pashtuns who are running around and saying, you know what, the Tajiks are ruling us. It is a drug dealer very well could create a force within his area to keep his area secure. Whatever happens, you call them enemies of peace and security. Yes, they are enemies of peace and security because they are disturbing peace and security. But who are they beyond that? The same thing with local warlords. Local warlords are there. Today, I mean, the frustration of Afghan government so much that they issued this statement to all the media in Afghanistan. I don't know if you heard about it or not, on January the 12th, saying please do not call the Mujahideen warlords, and also saying that you cannot report about anything about the Taliban. Or, I mean, it's a kind of, if you want to read it. So even the media freedom is being under attack because there's no way how to deal with these people. So if you want to look at the enemy in Afghanistan, you cannot sequence it anymore, unfortunately. You have to look at certain things. You have to look at narcotics. You have to look at these bodies of armed people who are illegal. Illegal means anybody who's not Afghan National Army, Afghan National Police, or its various components are illegal, and identify them. Once you name them, you can find a problem for them. But the problem is that, again, it's a catch-22. President Karzai says, for example, in the recent appointments of a police chief who apparently, at least some people claim that was a torturer and a hostage taker, his reply was apparently that, look, it's my dealing, I have to deal with Afghanistan, and Afghanistan was not a quiet place, I have to make specific arrangements. Let me take care of them. Which he has a point to that because he knows about it. But again, the donors are frustrated, especially the Europeans, they are frustrated beyond what they say out on the media. Because they say, look, our money is going, this is giving us a bad name. And I believe in this town also the frustration level is rising because it's not working the way it was planned to work. Also another issue which I think is
quite important, goes back to the heart of it. Human security is one, but on the international level is the issue of Pakistan and Afghanistan. On the face of it, there are two allies, strategic allies on war and terror with you know, United States of America. But when you read it, they meet. Some of them are meetings on arm twisting. The foreign minister of Afghanistan just came back from Pakistan. Good words were stated. But when you look at the statements again, it says the origin of terrorism is outside the Afghan borders. That is Pakistan involved? No doubt. Is Pakistan involved as much as Afghanistan claims? We do not know. To a degree, Pakistan has its own problem. Just today, 7 Pakistani soldiers were blown up in Miran Shah, 4 miles outside of Miran Shah, which is the capital of North Waziristan. To a degree, the Pakistanis do not control most of the Fatahs. These are the federally administrated tribal areas. There are 7 Fatahs and then 3 adjacent ones, so there are 10 basic units in Pakistan. That is, Pakistan is Pakistan spawned something that they can't control either right now. Does Pakistan have a policy to control Afghanistan? Indeed. They have always had it. It goes all the way back. I don't want to go back to Afghan history. It goes back to the day Pakistan was created, when Afghanistan was the only country that cast a vote of the only negative vote for Pakistan's entry to the UN. It also goes back to a wonderful border between the two countries, where Afghanistan has not recognized it up to today. Today, they still call it the Durand Line, the name of the 1893 British Secretary of British India, Sir Martin Durand, and nobody's recognizing it. So there is this animosity that Pakistanis and Afghans, it's again, both sides are blaming the other side that you are not doing enough, which is time, if you really want an international solution to it. First and foremost, I think Afghanistan and Pakistan have to be brought into a situation where the bickering has to stop, and more importantly, it's not the handshakes that are forced by somebody else from the outside, but they have to understand that these are two countries, sovereign, with a border, that border, demarcated, internationally agreed upon, and they have to live. They don't have to love each other, but they have to live side by side. Until that happens, Pakistan will always create a leverage. And the Taliban, as Minister Jalali said, they always looked at Al-Qaeda different than Taliban. It is their leverage. They will not give it up. You know what? About the Pakistanis stated that, you know what, the United States will be there for 10 years, but we have to live with Afghanistan forever. They're looking at their own strategic. On Afghanistan's side, friendship with India is wonderful. But India's friendship does not mean, if you bring the Indians as a strategic partner against Pakistan, basically there are 2 elephants in Afghanistan and a mouse will be basically gone. Today you hear more and more Indian cooperation. When I mean cooperation is not cooperation, is good, but when you bring Indians into your government and as advisors, that creates a tension. So tensions have to be brought down in order to create a joint fight. I don't think the Taliban phenomenon will go away until Afghanistan and Pakistan meet eye to eye. And who's going to do that? I think that's the main question that we do. And again, just last week, President Musharraf said that he knows, and I have a quote, "We are certain that Mullah Omar is in Afghanistan and are reorganizing the Taliban." A day later, President Karzai said that he knows definitely that Zawahiri and Mullah Omar are in Afghanistan. So they both know for definite. Where are they? This is the question. You know, nobody's really... The words I'm using, certain, definite. Both know by certain and definite that they are in each other's countries. So, with the other issue that I want to talk about is that right now Afghanistan is also mentioning something which is, I think, my view is very dangerous. The buzzword is community policing. It's basically creating militias. Pakistan is also looking at it, believe it or not. They are both looking at tribal militias to take over the places where there is no security. Afghanistan says that tribal militias will work because nobody else is there. So these areas that are no governance, you rearm. Or what, as one Afghan official said, they have had arms for 10,000 years. We are basically bringing their arms under our control. Well, that's wishful thinking. You're basically recreating new militias. Here's the Japanese paying millions of dollars to disarm the militias, and here you're creating new militias. A solution, again, in Afghanistan, when you look from 2001 onward, the solutions have always been tactical and ad hoc rather than long-term and strategic. If I want to say one thing, Afghanistan's solutions have to change dramatically from ad hoc, tactical, to long-term strategic cohesive and not sequencing. You have to sequence to a degree because we can't do everything humanly at the same time, but it has to happen in a strategic manner because the enemy is very smart. The enemy is smarter, and this is where I think my fears come in, beyond Afghan state building, beyond what NATO and OEF does, beyond ANA. What you have right now in Afghanistan is, I also happen to look at before coming on Afghanistan, my job was to look at nuclear issues and terrorism and what they like about it. Right now, if you look at what Al-Qaeda does, and for me, there are many Al-Qaedas. I'm looking at the Al-Qaeda in Pakistan-Afghanistan area. They're looking more at a way to create a strategic hole for themselves. They're not looking to destabilize Pakistan right now, but they're not looking at Afghanistan right now. Their target is Pakistan. They're not really worried about Iraq. Iraq is a killing field for them. They're just there. They're happy in a way that U.S. is bogged down there. They're looking at Pakistan as a potential one day to not take over Pakistan and have an Al-Qaeda flag on it, but to have a Pakistani-friendly system Al-Qaeda-friendly system in Pakistan. Read their letters, read their proclamations. Who are they calling on? Pakistani military, the Pashtun tribes, the pride. If they can get that, then we can discuss what Al-Qaeda would or would not do with a WMD-friendly state. But their strategic goal is right now destabilization of Pakistan, eventually to take it. Their hope is to bring it under their control indirectly. They want holes. They want land. As Minister Jalali said, they want areas. Right now they have Fatahs. They have major chunks of Fatahs, and also on the Afghan border, they have the same thing. What we have to look at, the enemy, in my view, the enemy is the Taliban, who have their own grievances. Part of it is human security grievances. Part of it is ethnic grievances. Part of it is narcotics. The second thing is there is an Al-Qaeda nexus. They are pushing the Taliban to do their own work, as they did when the Taliban were in government. They used the Taliban for their own jihad, whatever they call it. So we have to be cognizant of that. They're not doing the fightings. Whether they're teaching the Taliban, perhaps. They could even learn it from the internet. A lot of these IEDs and suicide bombings are on their websites. I don't know if you looked at the Taliban website. Now they have a very good functioning, amazing website. Unfortunately, the English site does not work. For those who, it is Pashto, and then Arabic works for half of it. Some things they are mirror images, some things they are not. I'm not going to give you a Taliban website, but if anybody wants, I won't announce it outright. But it is functioning.
I want to pause it.
Which is a remote radio station, and they do broadcast. So they are getting more sophisticated, whether this Al-Qaeda is paying them or learning, or they're gaining from drug money, I don't know. I will end, as my time is finishing, on a few solutions, because it's easy to point to problems and not to point solutions. My number one solution is reassessment, yes. An absolute reassessment on all levels, within the parties and within each group. This also, I think we have to look at NATO and OEF. We are still not sure how they're going to function. Right now, the largest U.S.-led military operation is going on in Afghanistan, Operation Mountain Trust. It's about 10,000 people involved in that. With that, that is a good point. We should have done this before. You can't deal with these people only with the Air Force. With all due respect to my Air Force friends, you need the Marines and the Army on the ground to do some work. And people will be killed. Hopefully not collaterally, but people will be killed. You have to understand that if you go to a war, people will be killed. So you have to prepare all the sides about that. And what NATO will do. Some NATO members are ready to do the job. We have to sit right now, not tomorrow. There are NATO members who think if a drug dealer runs away from them, they'll wave at them. If there's a shot fired, they'll go to their bunker and say, you know what? This is not our job. We have our national caveat. That would not work. And you cannot only rely on the Brits and the Dutch all the time. You need more cooperation from some bigger countries. So that's the second thing. And Third, again, Pakistan. You have to create an understanding between Afghanistan and Pakistan. How you do it, I wish I had the answer. If I did, most likely, I don't know where I'll be. And accountability. Afghanistan, I think this is where Afghanistan takes a responsibility. It has been a habit of the Afghan governments, not only this one, most of them, to point fingers outside. It's always outside. They have to be brought into, maybe not publicly, but privately, that there are certain things that you can do also. Corruption is very important. Corruption is now getting worse, not better. Worse, not better. Some people say, Bet was telling me, you know, that Afghanistan complains that they don't get their aid money. Well, there are people who are fearful that if they give them the aid money, that's going to go in somebody's pockets or going to become another little palace in some usurped land in Kabul. What are you going to do with that aspect of it? So this, you have to look at it in the sense of responsibility. Warlords. In Afghan parliament, there are a lot of people who shouldn't be there. It's not President Karzai's job to take them out, but there could be mechanisms that some fingers are pointed. So other things, laws are made and they are not followed through. The Afghan parliament ousted 5 ministers, gave them vote of no confidence, and 7 out of 9 judges of the Supreme Court. They're still there. And they're still functioning as if nothing happened. If you want to respect the parliament, the National Assembly, respect their views, whatever it is. Remove them. And I think the Afghan government needs to do that. And then lastly, again, I want to say it again, strategy versus tactics. It has to be strategic, looking at the base of both the Taliban insurgency, why they're there, human security problems, but also what Al-Qaeda is doing, and try to find a formula that looks at all of this, name the enemy. We can't talk about a vague enemy out there that is kind of roaming around, we don't know who they are. And once we have that, we may put Afghanistan on a path, and expectations should be leveled. Afghanistan is not a democracy. It has many democratic institutions. It actually has a parliament. A lot of countries around it doesn't. It is a functioning, to a degree, functioning parliament, which is wonderful. We should build on it and not use that as a model, say, you know what, this is wonderful, job is done. And the same thing, to make sure that, you know, if you have a constitution and a parliament, doesn't mean the country is already a democracy or even a civil society. Make sure that the civil society is built from the bottoms up to use these mechanisms which are put on Afghanistan from the top down, and hopefully you have a cohesive system long term. Bring in the expectations down on all levels, and maybe at least we'll not lose it. My fear right now is, have we lost it? I don't know who that we is, international community, which I don't know what that is, but have we lost? Not yet. Are we losing it? If we don't do anything, unfortunately, yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, I read 2 dozen articles today on Afghanistan in preparation for this meeting, and I realized that after reading them that I really didn't learn even a tenth as much as I learned from these two gentlemen today, which shows me the value of this working group. I'd like to open up the floor for questions, and I'd actually like to ask you to go to the microphone that's in the middle of the room and identify yourself, please.
Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute. Is this on?
That's a good question. It should be.
Should be.
Okay. All right. We'll see. On the issue of security, the American strategy was shock and awe. Familiar one. Initially, there was awe in Afghanistan. Appears to me we have lost the awe. Our enemies are not in awe of us. How do you regain the awe once you have lost it?
The awe.
But I don't know how to respond to this question, but so far, the response to challenges, security or otherwise, have been of tactical nature. And sometimes the responding tactically can undermine strategically. You will have something advantage, temporary advantage, or dividend. However, it can undermine long-term preferences. That's the nature of things happening in Afghanistan today. So therefore, I don't know how you get that back. But I don't know if that can answer your question or not.
I think the shock and awe was more for local consumption than the job. And again, I agree with Minister Jalali. It was, those are the things that had tactical short-term effect. The fact, you know, after two of our embassies were bombed in Nairobi and also in Dar es Salaam by lobbing 70 cruise missiles. I think we killed 4 people or 6 people, something like that. It's not about how many people, but it wasn't very much. There was this whole thing of missiles were coming in. The attack against the Taliban, there was a lot of technology, but at the same time, bin Laden bribed somebody and just walked to Pakistan. So it was more on what happens on the ground, more from, I think, the truth, the way these, if you talk militarily, you don't need shock and awe. You need little tactical things happening. Nobody knows about it. It happens. What would awe the Afghan people, in my view? Right now, the short term, they should not be awed. There should be a plan that has a specific step-by-step thing that I personally don't have to agree. I don't look at the London Compact as very positively. It has to be much shorter term, maybe a year or two. And this year, this is going to happen to you guys. And if that happens, I think you're awing the Afghans. For what happens stateside, I would not discuss that.
Please.
Javed Zirak with Afghan American Chamber of Commerce. First, thanks for the insightful presentations. A couple of questions. First to Mr. Tarzi. You seem to suggest that the Afghan government, or at least the stakeholders in security in Afghanistan, are in some way blindfolding themselves and do not want to really know the enemy. And that, to me at least, suggests some level of hesitation and reluctance. What do you think is the source of that on part of the government, the reluctance to know the enemy and acknowledge them for what they are and to tackle with it? Secondly, to Minister Jalali, for those of us living outside the beltway, political favor and popularity in this town seems to be as predictable as the weather for the past 2-3 days. And lately, as Mr. Tarzi has pointed out, President Karzai is out of favor in this town lately. Latest in Washington Post, an article came expressing high levels of disconfidence, a lack of confidence in his performance. And I don't know if you share my view that popularity in this town is not a good indicator of performance. You were with the man during the honeymoon period, as Mr. Tarzi said. To what level can we take to task Mr. Karzai for what has been happening since then? Thank you.
Thank you. I'll give you a short answer to that. I think it has to do with President Karzai's own lack of confidence in his base of support. He had this idea, the consultation with the Taliban started on the day that Mullah Omar escaped from Kandahar. I don't know if you recall, back in 2001, there was a so-called Great Escape. U.S. had a list of people that were supposed to have been handed over. They were all let go from Kandahar. Karzai was in Uruzgan at the time, but people who were in Kandahar, they let go of these people. And even at that time, there was this idea that they needed a Pashtun-based support. That's, you keep them. I think that the reconciliation program, again, is open to debate whether it has succeeded or not. There's this notion, if you keep on talking Taliban in the Afghan system and even outside equals Pashtun. So you are letting know everybody that the enemies are Pashtun, and not only Pashtun, but mainly from certain, the Taliban base was Kandahar, Helmand, Uruzgan, Zabul, where the fighting is going on. So that's where they are. I think that's the notion to not name them, to keep it vague, because they want to show that enemies are beyond that. Thank you.
Well, one article in the Washington Post does not mean that Mr. Karzain is, not of grace with the United States. Karzai still has a very, standing on very solid ground. And therefore, I think he needs to be helped. He too himself should also help himself, because during the past 4 years, he has been against a team or a political party. Political parties were discredited in Afghanistan in the past. However, it does not mean that you can just reject politically forever. Political party that could help President Karzai to formulate good policies for him and see them through implementation all over. Otherwise, he is forced to do tactical dealings with all power holders and influential people. Now, what he is doing now, you know, doesn't make sense. 1 year ago, he was not doing things like this, bringing Fahim Khan back, you know, in rejecting the process of selection of police projects, which started a year ago, and then, you know, examinations, interviews, background checks, all these things. And all of a sudden, he pushed that process aside and bring some people from networks, from network and appoint them. Why is he doing this? Because he does not have a team to help him. At the same time, with the kind of perception that the international community is not helping him too much, so he's going back to the power holders. That's a danger. I think he needs to be helped. First, should be assured that the international community is going to help him, whether it is NATO or it is in the United States. Second, at the same time, he needs a team, a party, a cohesive team to help him. Not a few people who will create a private club around him. No, a team, a political party. That is the kind of a help that he needs. So therefore, with all these, I think he's still he's standing on solid ground. He's an elected president, and so therefore, he will stay until his term, and if he just runs for re-election, probably that will be also a possible plan. So therefore, the bottom line is, he needs help. He should be helped.
I'm going to Jonathan and then Lou Hughes and this gentleman.
Jonathan Lande, formerly of Knight Ridder and about half an hour ago, McClatchy Newspapers.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
We'll have to change you on our list.
As Amin knows, last August I spent a lot of time with the troops in Zabul province up in the mountains. It's an area of about 19,000 square kilometers, the equivalent of Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island combined. There were 900 American forces for that entire area. And the villagers were complaining about the fact that we only see you once a month and you want us to turn in the Taliban, and what's going to happen when we don't see you for another month. I would like you to speak to, please, the question of resources, American resources, and dedication to this enterprise in Afghanistan, and how that has figured in to the deterioration of the situation there. Has the administration dedicated the money, the manpower, and the policy-making time that is required to get Afghanistan right? And if it hasn't, how has this contributed to the deterioration of the situation, not just in the South, as Amin points out, but also in the North and a little bit in the West as well? Thank you.
Well, you work for the Congress, right?
Okay. So well, let's forget about numbers. Numbers are not going to help you, nor the amount of money. Wise decisions and good policies are the key. Now, in 2004, you had 16,000 coalition forces in Afghanistan. The situation was much better than today, when you have 23,000 or 26,000. Yeah. At that time, ISAF was only in Kabul, and only a few PRTs around the country, and ISAF had 5,000 troops there. Today, it's 9,000. But the situation is bad. You cannot put soldiers everywhere in any village. You have to, win the trust of the people to cooperate with the government. And people will not cooperate unless they trust the government. So therefore, it is not the number of troops. It is winning the trust of the people. In the past, in Afghanistan, the situation was such that the central government was weak in terms of delivering services. However, the communities were strong. So therefore, the communities actually had the trust to obey the government, and one police officer from a district headquarters will go and sometimes will round up the whole village. And there was no protest to this. So it is the legitimacy. The people should respect the legitimacy of the government and believe that the government is protecting them, at the same time delivering services. Unless you do this, the legitimacy is gone, and therefore only the number of troops are not there. Yes. And one says that, case, you have to have troops in order to provide or constitute or create favorable condition for reconstruction. In an area where you want to implement development programs, you have to secure that area to protect this area. The Kabul-Kandahar highway, when we were building it, we deployed about 1,500 police officers to protect it. I lost 10 people the whole year, but the highway was constructed. And that was very much appreciated by the people. Now, you should have the capacity to protect the highway between Zaranj and Dilaram, and when Indians are building it, and there were many attacks against Indians, and now there is some concerns about whether this highway will be built or not. The highway between Ghazni and Kalat, between Zabul and Shinkai, these are the highways. When you built it, it will help you to bring security. However, if you do not have the troops to protect this construction, It is not going to happen. So only the numbers are not. Although in some studies it is suggested that the level of security depends on the level of investment, number of troops, in time, in a post-conflict situation. However, what I believe, what I've seen it myself, I think good policies are the key, and also winning the trust of the people. People are not going to trust the government just easily. Afghanistan is not costly, but it's not costless. And so far, with the initial euphoria of the defeat of the Taliban, it was considered that this is very cheap operations. So you cannot rebuild Afghanistan, as I always say, on the cheap.
I agree with the fact that an insurgency, you cannot really beat it with a lot of military force on the ground. Long time maybe, but I'm not one who says that there should be more troops on the ground. Different tactics, yes, but not more troops. In my view, it's also different policies. As I mentioned, I am still concerned about NATO's lack of cohesiveness on their tactic. They're putting the entire alliance, whether the alliance is worth keeping or not, I'm not one to say, but the entire alliance is kind of, the report card of Afghanistan will mean whether NATO should, is successful or not, or should exist or not. And when you look at their mandate, I'm talking about individual mandates, it is extremely vague. This will allow the insurgents, they're talking about it, read their websites, read their chat rooms. They see NATO as an easier target, as a much bigger target, and softer target. And it's all supposed to not the U.S. NATO is, for them, even Turkey, we have a friend from Turkey here, Turkey is a Muslim country, but they see NATO as a Christian force, as a crusader force, in the land of Islam. Defeating NATO is a big thing. And it's not defeating all of NATO. Even if you get one NATO member to withdraw, that's big. So it's not number of troops. And as I totally agree with Minister Jalali in how to win hearts and minds and bring security, but more importantly, when you go fighting, how you fight it. And in that, I think, as I said, one of my last remarks was, we have to sit down with NATO, not we in the U.S., but NATO as a whole sit down, and now they're meeting in Riga. Afghanistan is the main issue. I hope they can sit down and bring some of the major NATO members who are big in size, but when it comes to activity, they're very small, to do their part.
I'm just struck by the paradox that's been posed by both of the speakers on security and accountability. Let's start with accountability first. President Karzai came into this situation with enormous goodwill on the part of the entire international community and a significant commitment in terms of troops and financial resources to get the economy jump-started and to create a situation of security. When he was elected as president, everyone in the international community said, create a cabinet of integrity. And they also said to him, we know that a significant number of your governors in the provinces, maybe a quarter to a third, are hopelessly corrupt. Replace those governors. Certainly, he did some good things on the cabinet and some bad, but the governors, he basically just moved the chess pieces on the board. He didn't take them off. And I would really like to try to understand why, with all this goodwill behind him, why, with all the support, did he not do those two things? What prevented him from doing the right thing? Because it would have given him credibility. It would have sent a very strong message to the people that he was really standing up to put Afghanistan on the right course. The second question relates to security. We spent, the U.S. government spent, $15 billion in the fiscal year 2005 on Afghanistan, $2 billion for reconstruction, $13 billion for security. Of that $13 billion, $10 billion were for the coalition troops, so it sort of goes in and goes out. $1 billion to stand up the army, $1 billion to stand up the police, and $1 billion counter-narcotics. I'm just kind of rounding the numbers, but it's a lot of money. And it's not chicken feed. Now, did we spend that money poorly? Did we have the wrong mix? Or do we have the right mix but the wrong execution? I just would love to get some insight on that. Thank you.
That's a question, that's an open question, that while the people of Afghanistan want reform, they want reform, the international community is supporting reform, and government has a high moral ground to do this. However, that's a lack of confidence that whether a person can take risk or not. And that's, again, I come back to the same question, that without a solid, cohesive party and team, it is very difficult for one person to make decisions. It's always tactical. And tactical decisions with power holders and wheeler dealers. Now, in many cases in the past 4 years, we saw that the people who had local networks, like General Dostum, like Ayub Khan, like Ismail Khan. Like the government always wanted to be, you know, thought twice to do something with them. While there were people with solid, you know, background and at the same time very creative ideas, but these ideas were not taken seriously. What happened? And this idea could backfire. So they were there, therefore. In a post-conflict condition like in Afghanistan after 25 years, the conflict memory is always something that bothers and affects everything. Conflict memories as that, what if? Because the country is, you know, underwent a very, very difficult time, 25 years. So therefore, that's one reason probably. However, it is not a good reason at the same time. I would agree with you. With regard to the money spent, I'll tell you that, at least for the police, I can say this, that it was expected that last year the new rank and pay system of the police will be implemented, and that will cost a lot of money and a big budget. And now, 1 year later, I see that rank and pay system has not been implemented yet. So where's the money? Secondly, this year, I think last year it was not $1 billion were not spent on police. This year, It's $800 million. It's projected. Mm-hmm. But I hear that the new equipment, new vehicles, will be delivered to police at the end of this year in December. Sometimes the money is pledged, but it takes a long time to commit the money. Mm-hmm. And then the contractors come. You know, take the counter-narcotics, you see. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. And it goes to contractors. The contractors will take it. It is chunk, and then subcontracted, and subcontracted, and so on and so forth. Last year, a contractor spent $40 million in order to destroy 200 hectares of poppy fields. And that cost the taxpayer $200,000 an hectare. And hectare of poppies, produces 40 kilograms of opium. And altogether, I think the value is $5,400, all of it. And then, on the other hand, police-led eradication was about, I think, 4,000 hectares. And spend less than $100,000 probably. So that the kind of object, you know, money that you spend, the way you spend it. And take the same thing with building other contractors, other things. Yeah. And now in 2004, if you remember, 2003, yeah. It was agreed that by the end of 2004, 1,000 schools will be built in Afghanistan, built or rebuilt in Afghanistan, 1,000. And by the end of 2004, you had 100, not built, but repaired schools, 100 of them. Right. Okay, there were many reasons. They mentioned many reasons. One was that in Afghanistan, the design was, based on the norms in the United States, earthquake proof. And that was not possible to implement in Afghanistan. They needed heavy, the machinery that was not available, and the skills were not there. So therefore, and many other reasons.
Yes.
And then later on, they changed the design, mm-hmm. and they made it lighter. The lighter, it didn't survive the winter snow in Afghanistan.
Right. Groups came in.
So, you know, these kinds of things happen, you know, mm-hmm. in many cases. I think showcasing some reconstruction mm-hmm. is the problem. Mm-hmm. What does it mean for counter narcotics? What does it mean in action and with the NMP in London? What does it mean with the Parliament in Dutch in Netherlands? Mm-hmm. What does it mean in here in Congress? In the other year, I think it was 2004 that there was a fever of eradication and spraying, huh?
Right.
And spraying and eradication. Now, eradication without alternative livelihood never worked in Afghanistan.
No.
In 1989, there was an agreement between USAID and a warlord in Helmand Province to destroy the whole poppy. He said, "Okay, I will destroy it, provided that you rebuild the Kajaki Dam, the hydroelectric." He said, "Fine, we will do this." This warlord, did his part. That next year, there was no poppy at all in Helmand. However, they said, well, according to the law, we cannot deal with drug traffickers or drug producers. So the following year, it boomed again. And I'm sure that Taliban stopped, poppy cultivation in 2001. Had they stayed in power the next year, they would not be able to do this. You know, the alternative livelihood should be considered as an end, not as a mean. When you change this culture of operation, then you can do the eradication. However, mm-hmm. eradication without providing alternative livelihood, not as a targeted, like give them a few sacks of cash reward, fertilizer or something. That's not going to do. Right. This is a very, very, tactical solution. The long-term solution is to change this culture. Yeah. And I think in Afghanistan, the effective policy would be to help farmers and crack down on drug traffickers who happen to be even in the government, who happen to be in the police, in the bureaucracy. crack down on them, help the farmers, that should be the policy. Instead of all of 1 year, they say, okay, let's go and destroy poppies in Helmand. Mm. So what happened in Helmand this year? It backfired. So, yes, the money was there, treasures were there, but how it was spent,
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm going to take one last question, and I'm going to ask you if you could ask a question after we close.
Okay.
Sir. I'm Dr. Malatman, president of Humanity International for Peace and Prosperity. Thank you very much for very delighted presentations. We learn a lot. I wonder how the entire situation, when you look at, as Mr. Rezaev put it, that there are three pieces to this puzzle. The international community, the Afghans, and the enemy of peace. In my thought, generally speaking, I'm not going to make a presentation, but just simply, Afghans were almost totally taken out of this picture, totally. I never noticed that those Afghans who really are concerned about Afghanistan, who want to build their country, who want to work with the country, they were brought into the picture at all. Very rarely, seldomly selected some people, okay, go ahead and do it. And those Afghans who tried to be part of the process, they were always, always pushed away. The second, the international community, instead of that, they really, to help it, actually they created more obstacle to the government of Afghanistan. I'm not convinced, if you could please help me to understand this, Mr. Karzai's government will never help to become a really established government. At the time he was president, and all the world was supported. Instead of that, to give economy to the central government to establish itself, then the money was given to the NGOs. I travel to Afghanistan every year. I just returned from Afghanistan, visited Kandahar, Zabul, Kabul, Ninghar, and Kapisa, so these provinces. And I went and I visited the military stations there even. So when you look into this situation, first of all, the reconstruction process, I'm not convinced that if the Western community really did anything regarding construction in a way that will be visible and understandable for the Afghan people, yes, the international community is with us. Yes, there are a lot of things on the paper, but I'm not convinced if there is anything on the ground that can convince the Afghan people, yes, there is something going on for us. Second, even I remember in 2002 when I went to the PRT in Jalalabad provinces, I said, please build the road. Even starting right from to the road which is going to the Tora Bora, they say, oh no, we are not going to do that because Al-Qaeda will use it. That, I don't think, was the right strategy. But anyhow, my question is this. Do you see any solution with the current situation that the Afghans are left out of, particularly those Afghans who are talented, who want to be participate, anything can go more effectively, one. Second, unless the international community change their policy, when I was reading some documents, they're saying we are working on decentralization in Afghanistan. What does that mean? I don't understand it. Decentralization for a country like Afghanistan, which is a tribal country, it's not even built as a nation yet. It's still a tribal society. We need to give more importance and more power into the central government in order to establish itself. And if we are working on the decentralization, for example, there were 14 entities in the government of Afghanistan, they became privatized. Basically, half of the body of the Karzai government was just put it into the market. I don't believe and I don't see any things in the U.S. policy and also in the international community policy who are really stepping forward to do some things basically to establish a central, strong government in Afghanistan. And I will be very happy if you could please comment on it. The last question is the economy. When you look at it in Afghanistan, the economy is going in a way that either you have to be a richer or poor. The middle community is disappearing. So who will want to be the poor? Obviously, everybody is trying to get to richer. So that put people in a way that they are struggling for their life and they have to find a way for it. So basically, the economic system, I believe, would be another thing if you could please comment on it to see what have been done about it. Thank you very much.
Such a long question, how much? Well, I will tell one thing, that without the international community, you would not have seen even the current situation in Afghanistan. Taliban would be there. Al-Qaeda. I think Afghanistan could not get rid of Taliban without the intervention of the international community. I think it was in 2001 spring when I wrote that in an article that Afghanistan cannot, you know, save itself from this without the international. In that time, the people of Afghanistan wanted the international. Even today, the Afghans want the international community. There's no doubt about it. However, how it should help Afghanistan, I think it is kind of a two-way traffic. I think there should be an internet. It is partnership. In a partnership, you have to agree on things. If there is a disagreement, that's a problem. I think the disagreement should be removed. And I mentioned the Afghanistan compact before because at least there was an agreement on this compact. And at least this was 5 years, although it's not long term, which should be an ideal thing for a long term. 5 years, it's interim Afghanistan development strategy. But there is an agreement. Now that the focus should be put how to implement it, and the mechanism to implement it, and the resources to implement it. That's the major challenge. Otherwise, you will be talking about all these problems forever and without finding a solution to them. Yes, when a country goes and commits a certain amount of money to contribute to the reconstruction of Afghanistan, say in the Netherlands or in England or United Kingdom or Germany, and they also had to respond to the parliament and to tell them how this money was used. In the United States, the Congress is always asking how this money was used and implemented. So the international community has a stake there. And on the other hand, Afghanistan too, that the president is responsible to people. They asked them what happened to the money that was, this question of... allocating money mostly to NGOs and contractors has been a very difficult issue for a long time. The government was not given not more than 20% of the allocated funds because of the lack of capacity. On the other hand, without giving them the money, the capacity does not develop in the country. And there was a brain drain from the government to NGOs and to other institutions. Yes, that's a problem. I think the ways should be found in order to, create that capacity in the government. The poverty you said, I didn't mention, yes, they say that the solution to the economic the problem of Afghanistan is to focus on reduction of poverty. However, reduction of poverty without, supporting the private sector is not possible. It is not kind of a socialist kind of economy to help farmers. You have to develop a very solid market economy in private sector in order to help reduce the poverty. So these are all issues that have been debated a long time, but the mechanisms to coordinate it and put it together is missing. That's why earlier I said that new body, coordinating body, that was suggested by the Afghanistan Compact is a chance, is an opportunity, but not as a five or six people sitting there, but as a mechanism at different levels and both vertically and horizontally. That probably should be a way in order to find better approaches for implementation. I can say only this.
I'll just say two brief things. One goes back to the first question also. I think in Afghanistan what they have seen, why President Karzai has been unable and unwilling to remove some of these. Actually, I wrote an article 3 years ago using the word musical chairs. They can just keep on going. There has not been maybe after 2001, because it was, things were trying, there were many problems. Al-Qaeda was the main problem. Taliban were kind of sidelined. There was not a way of going back and seeing who has done what, like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission or even a name calling. So you have the same elites who come back from the Mujahideen days. They're still there and they have power and it's very hard to go around them. And that's the musical chair. Some of these people need to be, at least maybe the best thing for them to do is step aside and maybe do good in a farm or something and not stay in the same place. There are other suggestions, but I won't go there. But the issue is that the problem is that these people are still there. So you're right, there's no room for somebody else coming out because they still are the powerful people. And because they're powerful, they have the guns, and they have backgrounds which are not, some of them are very illustrious, they do not allow anybody from outside. And on last issue of centralization, it just happens to be the title of my dissertation, so I can't leave it alone. I totally agree with you. I believe that, and this is why I was worried about new militia forming. In Afghanistan today, you need to bring in the center. The periphery is very important. You have to give them their autonomy. But if you create decentralization right now, you can create decentralization when Afghanistan reaches Switzerland model. But right now, it basically is you creating a fragmented system which nothing would work. So I totally agree with you on that one. The economy happens to be not my strong point, so I'll yield on that one. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dalali. Thank you. I'm in Targi, and thank all of you for coming.